Hi, this is David Sweet, CEO and founder of Focus Core Japan. And if you are like many of the APAC leaders that I speak to, you're struggling in Japan to find the right talent. You get bombarded with irrelevant resumes or a lack of resumes altogether. I would like to invite you to discover the power of Focus Core's retained search. Let Focus Core help you swiftly secure top-tier talent in this candidate short market. I'd like to invite you to shoot me an email and explore how we're different, and with 100% refundable trial, we can revolutionize your hiring process today. Now on to our podcast.
There are a couple of big ones. I mean, one, obviously, the whole transition to zero emission vehicles, the increasing autonomy, the increasing self-mobility in vehicles. Those things are happening, and we're fundamentally going to change the whole value chain proposition.
Welcome to the Focus Core podcast. We are live in Focus Core's office in Kyobashi, and I'm here with Magnus Hansson. I'm very excited. He is the managing director of Jaguar Land Rover in Japan and has been leading them here for over a decade now. So welcome, Magnus.
Thank you, David. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start off with a question. Why did you choose to lead a Jaguar Land Rover in Japan specifically?
It was just a great opportunity. I mean, the chance to work with these fantastic brands in a country like Japan. Me personally, I have a connection to Japan. In my core, I'm Swedish. I grew up in Sweden. My dad's Swedish, but my mother is Japanese. So there was a very natural connection. And then, finally, a great opportunity to come here came through this job. And so it was too good of a fit to turn down. And, came here with a family almost 11 years ago and just had a great time.
That's great. Because growing up in Sweden, you started working, as we were talking previously, in the auto industry straight out of university and have had a rich career throughout that. So kind of walk us through that career for us.
Sure. The ironic part is that I'm actually not a petrol head in any way. I've come to love cars, but if you're going to cross-examine me on horsepower and torque numbers, I'm just not that guy. I'm pretty normal education in Sweden. At the end of the university, like in many countries, the companies will come to the recruitment fairs and try to attract talent. The key thing I knew about was I didn't want to work in a domestic Swedish industry. I wanted to work with something very global, right? A global arena, international type businesses. And then, more by accident, stumbled upon Saab. Again, I'm not being a petrol head, but I was very, very passionate about the brand of Saab. Just such a unique, lovely brand, very rich story, very unique type of brand and a proposition. And of course, a truly global company that could give me opportunities to, get into what I wanted to do. And then, of course, once you start working in it, I mean, it's an incredibly rich and fascinating industry. It's taking me many places over the world. I've had lots of great career opportunities. So a little bit more by accident rather than, being a petrol head with a very specific dream and a desire to work in a car company. A little bit more by accident. That just kind of was the right fit for me. And I mean, I've just kind of taken that opportunity and ran with it. And, unfortunately, Saab doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it went through a pretty complicated story. That's maybe for another podcast. But the passenger car brand of Saab ceased to exist in 2011. And then after that, I had an opportunity to move to Hong Kong. And then, of course, this opportunity came up. I've been really blessed with the opportunity to work with great brands. And it's given me a very, very rewarding career, personally and professionally.
You've led all over the world. You have a very rich background in leadership. Talk a little bit about what you found surprising moving into Japan and leadership here when you came over.
So as I mentioned, I mean, in my core, I'm Swedish. Mm-hmm. I'm educated in Sweden. And I'd say I have a quite typical Swedish leadership style. You know, I'm very inclusive, focus a lot on trying to encourage people to speak the truth, build a very motivational and supportive environment, communication style and so on. I mean, I don't believe in intimidation or, you know, threat-based, authority-based leadership. So, you know, in my core, I'm very Swedish as a leader. And there are lots of actually similarities between Swedish style and Japanese style. I mean, Japanese style is clearly more authority-based, you could say. But looking beyond that, right, there's lots of similarities in terms of group orientation, team orientation, building consensus-based decisions, inclusive decision-taking, building trust and communication styles. So for me, it was very, very natural and very easy to adapt to being a leader in Japan. But then, you know, there are other type of challenges, you know, so maybe as an example, maybe one thing that did surprise me a little bit was that even quite senior Japanese people, they're reluctant to have clear, strong opinions. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit reluctant to take decisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think really what's driving it, I mean, I guess you have the nail that sticks out, the loss of face. Yeah. And the fact that most Japanese people are never really encouraged to form strong opinions through education and early career, right? And you can't really eradicate that.
Yeah.
But that did surprise me a little bit. But even relatively senior people had that trait.
Yeah.
But that's something I figured out quite quickly. And you can adapt to that and figure out ways to complement each other. So, yeah. So it's really, you know, largely, I mean, I'm lucky to come from a culture that has lots of natural, organic similarities in leadership style. But, you know, there's areas where you have to pinpoint as to how to complement each other, right? Effectively.
So as you mentioned, I think the communication style in Japan is very nuanced, even on leadership and leaders. And a lot of our listeners are in APAC working with Japan.
Yeah.
And they find sometimes Japan an enigma to communicate with and not always getting a true representation of what's going on and having to struggle. How have you found, you know, success to work with a nuanced communication style within Japan?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit tricky, but, you know, I think fundamentally as a leader, again, figuring out how to complement each other's strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. But, you know, fundamentally, what I try to do is I try to avoid becoming too vague myself. I try to become relatively clear in a direction, vision, what's expected, a framework. I find a need to repeat and clarify to avoid any misunderstandings or remove some of the big picture questions. And then, you know, time permitting, what I find quite effective is to back away a bit, right?
Okay.
Give the local team a bit of time and space and flexibility. Let them come up with joint solutions. Let them come up with joint approaches that they feel comfortable with, that they believe in, and they feel they can do. And then kind of get back into it, right? So a little bit stop and go, you could say. But I think, you know, the key thing is to avoid becoming too vague yourself, right? To be quite clear of what's expected, what needs to happen, a framework for parameters, but also allow them space. Allow them space and flexibility to jointly come up with stuff they believe in and they can do.
That's great. Yeah. So really working around building out what the outcomes are and then letting them create the process that they're bought into.
Exactly. And that comes into the whole group mentality.
Yeah.
The consensus, the inclusiveness part, rather than, you know, just dictating down to granular detail. There are occasions where you need to do that. But by large, time permitting, I find that quite an effective way to drive a team forward here in Japan.
Yeah, I agree. It's too often, I think, from Gaishke companies where APAC or HQ's driving decision-making say, you got to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Or why aren't you doing that? Mm-hmm. Why aren't you delivering? And it's very top-down and accusatory. And it just closes off that communication channel
mm-hmm.
instead of welcoming that kind of bridge mm-hmm. of joint creativity. I think that's
mm-hmm.
important in leadership. In
Japan. No, you're spot on. And of course, you know, one of the inherent challenges is, yes. of course, that Japan is such a different animal, where in many global companies, of course, you know, all cultures are different in one way or another, but Japan really is a very different animal, you could say. And that creates communication expectation gaps. But at the end of the day, I mean, that's largely the job of a leader to help form and build those bridges, myself individually, but also, of course, to find and identify and support the right talent that can operate in those type of environments where fundamentally a company is a joint team. And, you know, my job, similar Japanese Gaishke leaders' jobs largely is how to build the local relevance, but obviously still leverage the know-how and the capability of a global strategy, a global team and all that. So it is tricky, I mean, given just how fundamentally different Japan is, and it doesn't really fit into many common business practices on a global scale where other markets are easier fits, right?
So, yeah, it's great.
But yeah, it's a fun challenge, and that's why I'm here.
Okay. What about... what's a common myth about your industry, about the automotive industry that...
I'd say that the most common myth, I think, is that this is a, you know, dinosaur industry that lacks progression and sophistication and innovation and so on. And I guess it's maybe based on very simplistic narratives that majority of cars still run on petrol and diesel.
Mm.
And, you know, there's, I guess, some generic similarities between the products of today and 100 years ago. Steering wheel, four wheels, you know, seating positions and all that type of stuff. So I'd say that's the most common myth I occur. The industry is brutally competitive.
Yeah.
And it's so capital intensive, and combined with that competitiveness, it's such a cutthroat industry. The industrial system that underpins it is incredibly complex, right? So normally businesses that have that type of complexity are B2B type businesses, trains, aircraft, boats, with similar complex industrial value systems. But passenger cars largely is B2C.
Mm-hmm.
Which means it's a consumer branding industry with that underlying industrial complexity. It's heavily regulated. I mean, safety, environmental requirements. You know, it's sold through a franchise system so that the distribution's been outsourced, so that you have to figure out how to control a franchise system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the products are owned for 15 years by multiple owners. There's an ever-changing infrastructure and interface with the clients that poses lots of challenges. You know, it's just an incredibly complex, but also very, very exciting business. And it's, you know, I could go on forever. But basically, it's very far from the stale dinosaur type industry. Yeah.
Can you share an area where you think it's very innovative?
So, you know, I think if you think of it, advanced engineering, like, I mean, if you think of the complexity involved in developing and manufacturing vehicles, they're incredibly affordable. So that if you think through times, right, I mean, the advanced engineering, the monozukuri, the skill, the logistics, the whole engineering and the manufacturing systems, I mean, just the immense complexity around it with just-in-time systems and all that type of stuff, meeting regulatory requirements in 100-plus markets. You know, if you really back away from it, it's incredible how cars are as affordable as they are when you think of the, you know, the vastness and the complexity of developing, manufacturing, shipping vehicles, time. Yeah, so I think, you know, there, you could say that apart from obviously the technological developments in actual products, which have been immense, right? If you think of, you know, the safety performance of cars today, the environmental performance, the properties of the car, but then combined with, you know, decades of refinement and innovation going into producing cars that majority of people can buy. Right? So it's really incredible. Yeah.
I'm always fascinated also taking it to the next step. You've talked about branding a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I find the innovation for selling cars interesting, and the things around how selling online and the e-commerce platforms put together, and how you can personalize cars quite quickly now, which is so different than you know, just 10 years ago.
So, you know, that's a good example where obviously the advent of technology, both in terms of devices, but also the evolution of the internet, the speed of internet nowadays, all that enables, you know, bringing that very complex variations and choices in a very easy and smooth way to the consumer. And, you know, so the technology is all there. I think in terms of selling behavior, however, I mean, cars are a seldom buy type of product. And it's also quite an emotional product. I mean, it's a seldom buy, relatively expensive, very emotional. I think we all have memories as a child going with our parents to a car dealership, a very different type of product. And what we can see right now is obviously the online presence and the online transaction is going to clearly increase. But, you know, in general, still to this day, majority of people once every third and fourth years want to take that buying process into a physical environment. They want to touch and feel it. They want to understand the sales executive they're dealing with. And, you know, so the majority of sales are still a combination of on and offline, but the offline element is very, very big at the bottom of the purchasing funnel still. Used cars is a little bit different. I mean, used cars is more, you're selling a thing, basically, right? And, you know, the mileage and, you know, all that. And, you know, in that sense, consumers seem to be more okay to buy and transact online. But for new cars, it's still very much largely an offline experience. Okay? But it's a blended on-offline journey through the funnel, right? So, but, you know, I think first and foremost, I think it's because of the reasons I mentioned, right? It's a seldom buy. There's emotional connections to it. It's a relatively large investment. You know, once every 3 or 4 years, you'll take the time to go visit your retailer.
It's a huge emotional buy. You have such cool cars, so it's an easy...
Exactly.
What's the biggest challenge that you're facing right now, and how are you tackling that?
So, you know, there are a couple of big ones. I mean, one, obviously, the whole transition to zero emission vehicles, the increasing autonomy, the increasing self-mobility in vehicles. You know, those things are happening, and we're fundamentally going to change the whole value chain proposition. Very fundamentally going to change the whole relationship with the client. So, you know, a really big challenge is obviously how to deliver and execute the business today, but at the same time, obviously preparing and adjusting for what's going to come in the future with massive changes in the whole value chain proposition, the client relationship. So that's one really big challenge. I'd say another big challenge for me is I obviously lead Jaguar Land Rover, our national sales company here in Japan. But then, of course, you know, whilst not legally speaking, I mean, indirectly, I'm the business leader for our retail franchise network, also for other partnership companies like our finance company and so on. And obviously, how to take all these individual Japanese companies along on this journey that we need to take? How to bring all these individual Japanese companies of different age and stature and geography and background, you know, understanding the journey we need to take, the transition we need to enact, how do we need to adapt their corporate cultures to deliver what we need to deliver, basically. And that's a big challenge because, like I mentioned, you're dealing with lots of different individuals, lots of different individual companies as part of our family. And, you know, that's something that requires a lot of partnership spirit, communication, dedication, and it's a long game, right? But, you know, I think after 10 or 11 years now, I mean, you know, we've come a long way on that journey, but, you know, there's lots ahead of us. So.
Yeah. It's always amazing to me that, especially in the automotive, because each brand's almost a conglomerate in itself, and mm-hmm. then it's not only different companies, but you're different industries.
Yeah.
Yeah. And trying to drive everyone in the same direction, pardon mm-hmm. the pun, but it's quite a challenge. So.
It is, and it's an inherent challenge in a way, like you mentioned, passenger mm-hmm. cars has largely been outsourced, the distribution part, into a franchise system, right? And then, you know, by definition, you're dealing with many different individual companies that are part of your franchise system. So I'm not legally responsible for them,
yeah.
but from a business point of view, I am responsible for them, and we need to bring them on that journey. Yeah.
Let's move over to recruiting in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I you're in the same boat with all of us with you know the market shortage. What strategies do you employ to kind of navigate the Japanese job market and the challenges that are inherent in that right now?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you know you need to be. I mean, I talk to lots of different people. I talk to lots of different other companies. Like you and your yeah. company as an example, and you know, from there you have to form a picture of what are the trends, what type of talents out there, what's important
yeah.
to different generations of talent, because it's different depending upon your age, your background, and all that type mm-hmm. of stuff. And you know, so you have to kind of form that picture, and the only way you can do that is to engage with lots of different people and stakeholders. But there's not a single person that knows it all. I mean, so, you know, you have to kind of open yourself up and get out there and talk to different peoples and companies. And then, you know, to be able to recruit talent, I mean, first and foremost, I'm focused on building our brands and our companies to be very successful. I mean, a place people want to work. But then also underpin it with a culture and a value system where people can feel respected, and they can feel that they can make a contribution. All the softer elements of how to motivate and satisfy people and get people working in the direction. So, you know, there's no easy ones. I mean, it's a long game, right?
Because yeah. I know, personally speaking, you guys are very effective in your recruitment, and I've been involved with your development, and you do a lot around people development, which is exceptional. It's a great way to retain talent. So I applaud you guys for that. Talk a little bit around diversity, because that's quite a challenge in the automotive, traditionally very male dominated. Mm-hmm. How are you developing your team around diversity?
Yeah, I mean, the business is, for a number of different reasons, historically more inclined to male, but it's changing, you know, and I think the way we try to tackle it is ultimately to create a non-discriminatory, value-based culture within our environment to make sure that we have leadership, both in words and in behavior, that actually truly manifests that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can't underpin it with a real culture and value system, I mean, it's just lip service or quotation, and it's not sustainable. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to do it properly, basically, right? And so that's something we spend lots of time trying to emphasize, both in words and behavior, try to live that. Mm-hmm. I mean, fundamentally, create a system where, you know, the only thing that really matters is your talent, your attitude, and your drive, right? I mean, no other superficial way on how to classify people should matter, be it gender or be it which school you went to.
Mm-hmm.
And all these maybe somewhat archaic ways of classifying
yep.
talent and individuals. So that's what we try to stay focused on, and you know, we try to foster that spirit and build internal talent pipelines that are as diverse as possible, no matter which emphasis you put on diversity. And then, you know, over time, that talent pipeline should organically translate into something that's representative of our customers,
mm-hmm.
which ultimately a company should strive for. It's like, you know, our customers are not only 55-year-old males. You know, our brands are not only liked by 55-year-old males, right? So, you know, we need to build the corresponding culture, value, company system that can meets and understand our clients' requirements.
That's great. I know that we talked previously, and I was very impressed that you've really tried to build out towards something that's realistic. Mm-hmm. It's long term, mm-hmm. and it will stay in place. It's not just something we're going to fill quota. That's not what it's about. It's mm-hmm. about building a talent pipeline mm-hmm. of the best talent that we can get that mm-hmm. that's sustainable for a long period of time. And I was really impressed by your thoughts around that.
Yeah, well, at Founder Day, I'm not going to be here forever.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to have this job for over 10 years. But, you know, there's going to be a day where I'm gone. And obviously...
You're talking to a recruiter, so you need to be careful right now.
But, you know, again, that's the cycle of business. Yeah. That's a cycle of life. And obviously... you know, a true sustainable culture transcends whoever happens to be the leader at any given point in time. And, you know, that's obviously my aim, to build something that I can be proud of and would stay in place the day I'm gone.
That's great.
Yeah.
What, if there had been any kind of challenges that you found in recruitment in Japan? And if so, how have you overcome them?
Oh, as many. I mean, it's a very difficult labor market. I mean, obviously, the demographic situation is what it is. But, you know, I think we share the same challenges that anybody else. I mean, there's a huge shortage of internationally minded, international capable talent in the market. There's a fear of working in foreign companies in Japan inherently. Working for a foreign company feels, oh, it's very different, or these companies are very small compared to the big Japanese companies, which, of course, is a fallacy. I mean, most of us belong to big multinational companies of same stature and same power and safeness as working for a Japan Inc. company. But that fallacy does exist in many individual Japanese people. You know, I think another very peculiar thing about Japan is also how impactful the surrounding family is, right? I think there's few cultures in the world where the mother's opinion to a grown male candidate is as powerful as it is in Japan, or how powerful the wife's opinion is on an individual candidate. And I'm not saying anything wrong with it. I'm just saying that it's unusual. How impactful the surrounding family's voice and perception is on individual candidates. And, you know, so there are many of these interesting quirks, you know, yeah. with the Japanese labor market and recruiting talent. And, but, you know, again, fundamentally, I don't think there's any magic silver bullets to it. I think it's obviously make a company successful, make it somewhere people want to come to, underpin it with a culture and a value system where people... feel that they can belong, they can add value, they can contribute, they're respected. And you need to partner up with good companies, because also in Japan, right? I mean, there's a very high dependency compared to other markets where candidates are uncomfortable to not go through a specialist company in between. And that's also particularly high in this market. So, you know, that's good for you guys, but it's a little bit more challenging for us.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, that's difficult to change that individual mindset. So you need to partner up with good companies that can help you also.
Yeah. You know, one of the stories I had with talk about families, I had a candidate who had an offer from Morgan Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
Also had an offer from, I think it was Tokyo Mitsubishi. Mm-hmm. I mean, but he went home, he wanted Morgan Stanley. It was more money, mm-hmm. better title, foreign company, could go overseas. He was very excited about that. Went home, mother-in-law, father-in-law, never had heard of Morgan Stanley. So it was dead at the get-go.
And that's the basic point, right?
Yeah.
And listen, at the end of the day, back home in Sweden or wherever you come from, you know, of course, to a degree,
yeah.
your surrounding family structure has some involvement,
yeah, yeah.
But I'd say that the level of involvement and, you know, how influential it is on individual candidates is unusually high, I could say. Yeah.
And when you're talking about, you know, going through recruiters in Japan, it is high, and people, candidates specifically, feel uncomfortable around negotiation and, mm-hmm. and speaking with the talent acquisition or with whoever's in charge of the hiring. And I think that's a key skill that internal companies, talent acquisition can really learn how to develop. And it's an easy win for them to be able to do their own talent acquisition, mm-hmm. not use recruiters, just mm-hmm. making the client, the candidate throughout the process feel comfortable mm-hmm. so that they can speak openly about salaries and say, we want to help you join our company. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. still a long way to go on that, but I'm hoping we'll get there. And then they can use recruiters for the difficult to fill mm-hmm. positions and mm-hmm. save their money to mm-hmm. hire more people that way.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, I think, but again, you know, I mean, working in a global company, I mean, that's often not a similar problem, you could say, in other cultures. Mm. So it's seldom be part of a global organizational footprint, right? So again, you know, you come into a very specific uniqueness with this culture, which is exactly the way you described, but you know, at the end of the day, I mean, markets and cultures progress. I mean, I'm sure that Japanese individual candidates over time maybe will feel more empowered and more willing to engage in these type of direct negotiations themselves. So I'm sure it's going to change. But, you know, again, it is what it is. And, you know, I think the key thing is to recognize it, right? So.
Yeah, we've been starting to do more like around talent acquisition process improvement mm-hmm. for companies and going in and just mm-hmm. consulting on how to do some of these mm-hmm. and so they can get these processes so they don't have to hire us to do those things, mm-hmm. which is a good thing to look at.
No, but yeah, definitely. I mean, we definitely have that need. And I mean, there's a global war for talent. Yeah. And that war for talent is particularly dire in Japan because of demographics and other reasons, you could say. And it's something we need to figure out how to step up to the plate. But, you know, again, many different priorities, and it's a long road, but it is something that we need to put on our radar.
Cool. Let's switch gears. You talked about long road, and I'm talking about switching gears. We're going to just have just bad jokes all the way through. Sorry to the listeners.
Well, at least you didn't say dinosaur.
What's the most important lesson you've learned over your career?
I mean, I haven't only worked corporates, right? Yeah. I mean, you develop as an individual, but also as a leader in many different arenas. I mean, sports was very important to my youth. I've been in sports leadership type of positions. I have military leadership training. But then, you know, when you boil it down, right? I mean, fundamentally, nothing is ever going to be handed to you, right? You have to earn it. You have to work smart. You have to be dedicated, committed. You have to work hard. You have to earn everything in life. And then I guess a little bit connected to that is, you know, you're not going to get very far by yourself. You have to learn how to bring a team with you if you want to go far. And I guess if I boil it down from my experiences in many different arenas, I mean, those would be the things, you know, I take to heart.
I like that. Yeah, you really do. And make your own luck. Mm-hmm. And if you work hard, mm-hmm. luck finds you, right? And then
hopefully.
Help and bringing other people along, because you can't do everything.
Well, at the very least, you increase your likelihood for being happy and successful if you really make the utmost effort. Right?
Mm-hmm. How's your leadership changed over the year? Years, not over the year. Over the years.
That's a good question. I mean, I guess there's a natural development in any leader. Like when you're very early in your leadership career, I mean, you tend to be maybe a bit more of a doer. You tend to be maybe a bit more involved in the granularity of stuff, wanting to be in control of all the ins and outs of stuff, which is natural when you're in early leadership. And I think, you know, over time, I mean, you learn how to a little bit let go. You learn how to more focus on the big picture, controlling the direction. Enabling deliveries, enabling a framework, building and assembling a team, how to delegate, how to prioritize. So, you know, for me, I don't think I'm different in that in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, I think that's kind of a natural transition I've gone through that I guess everybody goes through. Secondly, you know, I think in terms of my style, I mean, I've always been quite comfortable in my leadership style. I've always been quite... confidence is maybe too strong word, but I mean comfortable in my natural true leadership style. But I guess, you know, one of the things I really learned how to do this very early in my career, I had a tendency to, you know, whatever was handed, I gave it all to make it work, be it an idea, be it a team, be it an individual, be it a project, whatever it is, right? With a little bit of youthful pride and brashness, I was going to make anything work, right? And I think, you know, with experience, you know, that's something you learn eventually, that don't be afraid of making the changes, right? When something is not going to work, if an individual is not going to perform, if a team is not going to work, if a priority is wrong, make a change. Like, and with experience, I've become pretty adept at, I guess, picking up on that rather than, you know, at any cost, I'm going to make this work, right? But you know, fundamentally, what you do is you waste individual and collective time on dead horses, right? And that's something I've learned with experience. So I don't think it's so much a style. I think it's more, you know, the common natural evolutions of young leaders becoming more big picture leaders. But then I'd say for me personally, that's been, you know, I'd say the most stark development for me is to, you know, quickly identify what's not going to work and not be afraid to change it so quickly. Yeah.
That's great. If there are any leaders, new leaders or mid-managers, I specialize in executive coaching for mid-managers. Mm-hmm. And there's two things I try to get them to do. Stop doing mm-hmm. and delegating. And the fear of just, you know, like you said, that something's going to die, that mm-hmm. I'm going to make this work. And mm-hmm. it's okay to just put it to the side. Mm-hmm. Or oftentimes you have to replace someone mm-hmm. and there's a fear that there's failure there. And I think the wisdom of age, that kind of dissipates, or a callousness mm-hmm. Away from, okay, it's not the end of the world. We're going to give someone the challenge, the chance to succeed somewhere else because they're not happy here. I'm not happy with their performance here, for example.
Exactly. And that's something you have to learn because I guess fundamentally, right? I mean, you know, if you're a reasonably minded person, nobody finds it fun to really manage poor yeah. performance or poor character traits. I mean, you know, it's not humanly comfortable to do that, right? But, you know, if you're a captain of a sports team or if you're in military leadership or corporate leadership, you're there because you need to take the decisions that need to be done for the sake of yeah. individuals and their collective. And you have to learn to recognize when change needs to happen. And figure out ways and techniques on how to do it without making it personal. Find better opportunities for somebody who can't perform in bad environments. Unfortunately, sometimes you have to get rid of people. Yeah. You know, and it's not, you know, again, if you're a reasonably minded person, I don't think anybody particularly enjoys it, but it's still you need to develop. Yeah.
Here's one for you, Magnus. If you could make all your employees do one thing with 100% dedication, what would it be?
Yeah, so yeah, I think it's a common problem in many organizations, but you know, I think it's a constant reminder that the enemy is outside of the house. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're in business or whatever type of competitive environment it is, business, sports, whatever, the enemy is not in our team, right? Stop wasting time conniving, fighting, bickering. On, you know, stuff that really isn't important, right? Figure out how to work together, figure out how to get stuff done, figure out how to make the best collective effort together.
That's awesome.
We're in this house, we're all the same team. And I know that's a quite simplistic statement, but it's a too common statement in whatever group of people you're dealing with, be it a project, be it a company, be it a franchise family, the enemy is not in this house. Yeah. We're all wearing the same shirt, right? And you know, we need each other to succeed.
Love it. That's awesome. So my last guest asked a question. So she asked, if you could collaborate with anyone, living or dead, who would it be and what would you hope to do together? Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, this is maybe a bit corny, but I'd love to work with Albert Einstein, right?
Nice.
I mean, I'm very, very interested in science, natural science, and astronomy and that type of stuff. And, you know, just be able to work together with his sheer brilliance. And I'm not sure he was a good guy to work with, actually, but I mean, just to be in the proximity of such an amazing mind, right? I mean, you know, one of the great gifts to humanity, Albert Einstein.
Yeah. What would you want to do?
I'd probably, you know, spend hours rambling about completely uninteresting astronomical theories and scientific stuff. I'm just really interested in, right? But you know, I guess first and foremost, right? How do you have the audacity and the braveness to be as visionary as he was? Incredibly visionary, right? Like, you know, that's something I guess anybody can. Get you know, benefits of, you know, having that skill and the bravery that he had. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Excellent. I love it. So we get to turn the tables now. So if what would you like to ask the next guest?
Well, you know, in this ever-changing world, right? I mean, maybe, you know, it'd be interesting if you're a really smart person to look about what his or her company is going to look like 10 years from now. That's what's the future of the office environment? You know, some of these questions I think we're all a little bit struggling with. I guess maybe something like that. Because, I mean, I obviously don't know who your guest is or which company it is. But you know, I think that would be fascinating to hear from a really smart, talented individual. Like, well, what's my company going to look like 10 years from now, including what are the working facilities going to look like? Is it going to be one location, or is it going to be 50 locations all around the world, accumulating talent, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, it'll be really interesting to hear that from a smart person.
That's good. I love it. We'll ask that, and I'll let you know. What should I ask you that I don't know enough to ask you?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Well, I'm happy you didn't ask how sales are going right now.
Okay.
We had a great year, 2023.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a bit of a rough start of the year. But, you know, we'll get
there. It's January still. It's so January. As we're recording this.
The teams are on it. So, you know, we'll be able to get through it. Yeah.
That's great. Well, Magnus, you are very well respected. I've talked to many people in Tokyo, said about you. And everybody always says very nice things about you. You're well-spoken, very intelligent, and knowledgeable about what's going on in Tokyo and in Japan and in business. So it's a delight to sit down and chat with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob. Great pleasure. I'm doing the uptown lowdown, yeah.